Welcome to Her Story, a project by Chick History. I'm your host, Rebecca Price. For 1 year, we asked 50 contemporary women to share the story of the historical woman who has inspired her. Join us every week for a new story of inspiration, from the headliners to the lesser-known gems.
Dust off the books, read all the letters, preserve with time. Dig out the truth written between the lines. Her hair's still brick, cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten.
Joining me today for Her Story number 13 is Cinnamon Catlin Legetko. Working in museums for nearly 20 years, Cinnamon has been a museum director since 2001. She is the former director of the General Lew Wallace Study and Museum in Crawfordsville, Indiana, where she led the organization to the National Medal for Museum Service in 2008. She serves as a council member for my organization, the American Association for State and Local History, and was the founding chair of their Small Museums Committee. Her recent publication, The Small Museum Toolkit, a six-book series in which she is the co-editor and a chapter author, was released by Altamira Press in December 2011. Cinnamon is joining us from Bar Harbor, Maine, where she is the CEO of the Abbey Museum. So Cinnamon, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, who's it going to be for you, Cinnamon, your inspirational woman in history?
I have chosen Margaret Mead, who was an American anthropologist. And she inspires me today as well as when I was younger.
Well, please tell us all a little bit about Margaret Mead.
Well, Margaret Mead was the daughter of two social scientists, and she was born 1901, very unique upbringing, which really plays out throughout her whole life. You rarely see how someone's childhood is a common thread into her adulthood and as she's remembered, but this is truly the case with Margaret Mead. She was homeschooled in part by her grandmother, who was a widowed classroom, or teacher rather, and she had some level of traditional classroom learning, but she had this great childhood where she was taught to document everything. She was taught to observe the world around her. Her mother documented every moment of her and her when she was carrying her in her stomach, as well as into her early years, trying to understand how she felt at the time her daughter acted a certain way or grew inside of her, or what have you. She had this incredibly documented life, which plays out, if you want to be an anthropologist, quite well. And one of the things that she writes in her memoirs about the power of observation, because she also, in turn, becomes a huge observer of her daughter, is that observation is a supreme act of love. To be observed is to be shown how much you are loved. And I thought that was a wonderful way of expressing why we observe others and why we consider what people do. So as a young lady, she heads off to school and she decides that she wants to study at Barnard. She actually started out at DePaul, which is something people don't realize. She started out in Indiana for a year and found that not to be a fit for her and headed off to Barnard and studied psychology. And it's around this time she meets her first husband, who was Luther Cressman, who was an archaeologist in his later life. But this was the first of three marriages, so she was quite adept at changing up things as she became unsatisfied. But early on at Barnard, she had exposure to Franz Boas, who was then known as the father of American anthropology. He was world-renowned, had really set the tone for what we know for anthropological studies today. And his teaching assistant for his career was Ruth Benedict, who became Margaret Mead's mentor and close confidant throughout her life. And what made Boas and Benedict so important is that they were proponents of cultural relativism, which, if you think about or know anything about anthropological theory, for decades, anthropologists really looked at culture and how we understood it through some hierarchical means, especially during the 1800s. The colonial area, which meant that you were ranking cultures, some above others, some being better than others, which, as you can imagine, leads to discrimination and other concerns in American society. But with Boas and Benedict, they were were committed to the idea of cultural relativism, where culture is understood on its own terms without a ranking system, that you experience culture as it's meant to be, and it's not different or wrong or something it shouldn't be. It simply is. And then Ruth Benedict takes it one step further, and again, this is Mead's mentor, that she really looked to popularize this notion that culture is relative and you should consider it as such and nothing else, and that there are essential patterns within cultures that you can understand. So you can probably imagine that in the 1920s or so, when she's really going to start in this field, that this is revolutionary thought. This is pioneering thought. We have a segregated South. We have a variety of ideas about how class and society should be leading into World War I and into World War II. And these folks in the world of anthropology are saying that culture is as it should be and that you shouldn't judge it in any way other than it is. And Mead's really attracted to this. And she's also attracted to the fact that there's an urgency of vanishing cultures in the modern world. Technology, contact era, all of these things are changing the way that distinct cultures are operating. And there's this incredible need to get out there and document and understand and solve some societal issues while she's at it. And her dissertation work under Boas really looks at the stability of certain elements of culture. And specifically in Polynesian culture, she's looking at canoe building, house building, and tattooing, about how those things happen in a very stable way, generation through generation, consistently through culture. So she's looking at patterns early on. She then heads off to Samoa, which is in itself an incredible act of bravery. A young lady in 1925, she's heading off to Samoa, and it's American Samoa. She's made a compromise with Boas. He was concerned about a young lady heading off into the wilds without any protection. And at the time, American Samoa had a base and a presence on it, American base. So there was an opportunity for her not to really go too deep into the wild as her first field work. But she heads off to Samoa, and she, as a result, studies adolescence. That was the problem she wanted to solve. She wanted to understand how young women in Samoan culture move through their adolescent years in comparison to American women. Young women. And is it as traumatic and stressful in Samoa as it would be for American women? And what she finds out is that it's not so bad in Samoan culture. And it's because of the way that they're parented. It's the way that the culture has supported them through their adolescence. And it's not very stressful. And her book, Coming of Age in Samoa, is the outshoot of this work. And it's incredibly successful. It's one of these rare moments in early anthropological studies where it crosses over and becomes widely read. And it's especially popular because she devotes two chapters in the book to how this implicates child rearing in the U.S. and how you can, in other words, ease up on how you raise your adolescents and you might get better results. So she's very much embedded in the world of psychology at this point, as well as anthropology, and popularizing these notions. And this really sets the stage for her career. And so from 1925 to 1939, it is, she's traveling mostly in Polynesia and other parts of the world to do some comparative analysis of her adolescent studies, as well as other areas of interest around personality. And as she changes locales, she's changing husbands. She comes back from Samoa and in the process meets her second husband, Rio Fortune, who is a New Zealander who was headed to England to study psychology. And they end up doing field work together in Papua New Guinea. And we're very committed to looking at the processes of the cognitive processes of children in preliterate societies. We were committed to documenting how children communicate without written language. And so through their artwork, they were able to document thought process and understand that what we know to be childlike thoughts varies according to a culture. So, for example, in American society, children in their artwork as they're young might have a lot of fantasy or supernatural characters in their drawing. But in a society like the Manu, which they were studying in Papua New Guinea, where the supernatural was part of everyday life, ghosts and superstitions and all these things, they find that the children don't have fantasy in their drawings. They're very much realist. And so it's culturally specific how you think as a child, which is groundbreaking. It seems pretty straightforward to us now, but nobody had really taken the time to look at this in science. So she visits the Manu in the 1920s, and she goes back after World War II, which I think is exceptional. She returns again and again to see how they're transitioning through the modern world. And she finds that the Manu have really changed dramatically and rapidly, and she posits that change was successful because it had been rapid, and that they had a charismatic leader, as opposed to slow change, really debilitating people going through cultural change. And it's really from this era, when she's visiting the Manu, that there's one of my most favorite artifacts in the world, and it's at the Smithsonian at the American History Museum. They have one of her fieldwork dresses, and it was specially designed with pockets large enough for her notebook so she could write down all that she was seeing. And it was constructed with a wraparound waist that she could expand or shrink based on the weight loss, because going into the tropics, there wasn't a lot of opportunity for her health to be regular. She was ill quite a bit and dealing with the food changes. So she would lose weight so she could cinch that waist and keep moving. And it was designed to handle the heat, but yet be very appropriate for the norms of society. And it's just the most simple, lovely dress in the world. And I remember standing in front of it when it was on exhibit a few years back and just being shaken and realizing that this woman had gone out into the great unknown, regardless of what people thought or what people thought she should be doing, got a dress for the occasion and went in deep and really changed modern thought in regard to gender issues and adolescence and how we think about childhood. She does further research in the Sepik region of Papua New Guinea. She's also in Bali. It's in Bali where she and her, I think she's on her third husband at this point, she's doing field work around visual anthropology, which was groundbreaking and pioneering. And it sounds very simple, but nobody had been doing it yet based on the technology available. When I say visual anthropology, it's the process of documenting a culture through photograph and motion picture. She's one of the first field workers to really document every moment of something being made or something being taught to a child or what have you. And in the end, there's a huge archive of photographs and film that have been preserved about Balinese culture. And at the same time, they're collecting artwork from children and really proving the ability to standardize fieldwork collection data and use it and collect it in ways that other people could use the research. So after this prolonged life of fieldwork, she focuses her language, her future thinkings, her career, if you will, around becoming a global citizen. So not only has she done world travel and she's lived a huge life, in the 1960s and 1970s, she is becoming an international figure because she's invited to speak on global issues, using anthropological techniques to understand what we know. We're talking about a world that's suddenly becoming global and interdependent, and she's advocating for the fact that we need to be global and independent, but we need to be mindful of cultural issues to understand these human concerns. And she starts to spend a great deal of time talking about solutions for world poverty, talking about healthcare and education, all these really incredibly important topics through the lens of an anthropologist. And she's based out of Columbia at this point, and she's known as a wonderful lecturer and supporter of her students. And she's just on this world circuit, working up until the very last day of her life, which was after 77 full years as Margaret Mead. She died of cancer. And she has her life documented in notebooks up until that very last moment. I was just looking at it online the other day. Her very last entry is documenting a conversation she'd had with Gregory Bateson, which was her third husband, and hadn't been married to him for 30 years. But it's the one person she did have a child with who has survived. And she's documenting that simple conversation of talking with him, and I think she passes away the next day. So from birth to death, she's a fully documented woman, and without hesitation, making those documents known for others. There were critics of her work who believed that she was too subjective or her field techniques were not useful or they couldn't be replicated. But there are also critics of her critics who really say that the world was changing fast. Of course, you can't replicate certain situations in the field because the modern world was coming in. And oh, by the way, if you tried to replicate it, you'd be susceptible to the same challenges. But she was so sensitive to that she made her papers available to other researchers so they could examine it, they could look at it, and they could understand the conclusions she made. And what I think is extremely notable, as a result of all this documentation, her papers, which are at the Library of Congress, are one of the largest collections of papers related to a single individual in the entire Library of Congress, which says a lot for a life well-lived and very thoughtful and provocative life that continues to inspire me to today.
And what do you take from Margaret Mead's life? What is it that inspires you and has affected you in your own personal life?
Well, for me, as an undergrad and graduate student studying anthropology, to learn about Margaret Mead and to see how she really just took the bull by the horns and went in the field to test these ideas of Boaz and Benedict was incredibly inspiring in itself. And the fact, too, that it really, her approach of cultural relativism, understanding that cultures are incredibly important on their own terms and not based on somebody else's criteria, was transformative for me as I understood how communities interact just in my regular life, or how people interact, or how it isn't appropriate to judge something from someone from where they come from. And those basic moral ground issues that, as a formative adult, you need to explore and debate and consider. And she, ahead of everyone else, was out there as a woman at a time where women didn't travel and like this, unaccompanied, or much less went and lived in third world countries, as we describe them today, trying to understand notions of adolescence, and sex, and gender. I mean, this is edgy stuff. And she is game for it, and she's ready to share with the world her notions. And that idea of believing so much in what you do and trying to understand something about another person, another culture, and then wanting to document it and share it back out, I think that's how I work through my life, my career. I work in the museum field, I study what we do while I'm doing it, and then I'm really empowered to document that and teach others or help others and publish about it. So I think I followed Mead's model in that way. I haven't followed her marriage pattern, fortunately, or her or her carefree way of living sometimes, but I have really been committed to the later idea of hers about being a global citizen and recognizing our interconnectedness and how we can't apply blanket statements to situations and assume that it's going to have the same impact. Everybody comes from a different place in their lives, whether it's cultural or because of nature, which is an ongoing debate today, just as it was back then, nature versus nurture, that you can't just apply a blanket statement and solve all the ills. You have to take the more nuanced approach and understand the cultural relationships that people have and how they've gotten to that point in their life. And when you do that, you'll find a solution that works for everyone. And I think it's an important lesson for just about everybody. And I contend to this day that any university that doesn't include anthropology as a required course just really isn't useful to me. Because it is an absolutely astounding experience to take that first anthropology course and realize the interconnectedness of the globe and cultures, but then to understand the diversity and how we've impacted each other through the years in negative and positive ways, and how everything we do is that we're at risk of creating irreversible damage if we're not mindful of it.
Well, other than the Intro to Anthro 101 for college students, what book do you recommend about Margaret Mead so people can start learning more about her?
Right, I know. There's a million books, but there's also a biography and an autobiography. Her autobiography is called Blackberry Winter, My Earlier Years. I don't think she ended up doing her later years, but it's a nice documentation of her approach to life. And then there's a biography by Jane Howard called Margaret Mead, A Life. There are other works that have been done much later. Quick Google search will find a variety of opinion on Margaret Mead. But I think one of the best ways to get a good breakdown online is the online exhibition that the Library of Congress has done on her as well. Hopefully we could link to that with the podcast.
Well, there you have it for Margaret Mead. Cinnamon, thank you so much for sharing her story with us.
Thank you.
To learn more about her story and other projects by Chick History, you can visit the website chickhistory.com. And please join us every week for another story of an inspirational woman in history.
I'm here to tell a story, something precious and fine, about a woman who made a difference with her life. She might not be known, but to only a few, her story remembered here is gonna change that view. Her history cannot be left behind. She shall not be forgotten. Her story not forgotten.